What I want to do in, I want to throw two parallel goals in this year. We're going to start from the Nakoro and then go back to the article. I want to try and analyze the Nakoro, especially the Narvi Vial, on its own, and then go back and see what we think of the responses attributed to Rabbi Greenblatt in the article. That's mostly what I'm interested in. Right? The article per se doesn't interest me as much, although I'm willing to entertain questions about it. What I'm really interested in is that there are three very specific vignettes set out in the article, and each of them have concrete responses that are attributed to Rabbi Greenblatt. Now again, I have no direct knowledge of whether Rabbi Greenblatt in fact said the things that are attributed to him. But these are presented as models for how we ought to, how journalists ought to handle situations by implicit contrast to the way Gary Rosenblatt handled the Weiner case. Although we could talk about whether the contrast is based on a misperception of the facts, and therefore it doesn't right. Maybe if Dr. Oppenheimer had known the facts that actually were, he would not have responded the same way. I want to take the basic McCord uses, and so far as I can tell, really, the article is organized around the Narvi Vial, and there really isn't much else. That we wouldn't have seen other than the Narvi Vial. If there's another McCord that you thought was really important, then tell me. But to me, this article was built around was, let's take the Narvi Vial as the normative thing. The Narvi Vial is the dominant postic in Ashkenaz, where it has a great deal to do with the way Hilton Scotchers develops. So we're not talking in medieval Germany, so we're not talking about a minor figure. And this trip, right, and this is truly likely, was a tremendously influential event as well. So I want to go through the background to this trip. I want to go through his truth in depth, and then I want to turn to the article and see whether you think the article is, how do you think the article relates to the Narvi Vial. And in context of that, in discussing the Narvi Vial, we also have to talk about how the reception history of the Narvi Vial, which is to say how the Narvi Vial was understood by literature that we have seen, especially by the Narvi Vial. Okay, and then with some 20th century stuff. Okay, so we have the case in Tanakh of the restoration of Beit Rishon, and so I gave you the Sukkim, and you can try and figure it out for yourself based on the Sukkim. Maybe I'll start with two ideas in tension. One idea is that they bundled and counted the money, and the other is that they did not seem to require specific accounting. Okay, sorry, I'm not going to get involved in what the chat is. It seems to me that in rabbinic sources, that tension is very nicely expressed in the Gemara of Basra Daf Tet Malach, which on the one hand says, "Ein achashim b'tzatim gadlai tzaka," on the other hand says, "Apo p'yishyechol adam giz barnyan on b'tzos peito, yotzur li ne." They're talking about the same case. So I think I'm justified in seeing this as a tension, and you can try and figure out what distinguishes the two phenomena. Okay. Shmuel Rabba also plays out the same tension in Moshe Rabbeinu, and that tension is then played out explicitly halacha in Yeridea Rishon Zayin Bet, where we say that Gadolim, right, first of all, Gadolim need not to commingle their private, right, their private business with public business. Okay, right, so Gadolim should not use public money, even when they have no public purpose to use it for. Nonetheless, they should not engage in business with the public charities that they're involved in, because it's going to look like self-dealing. That's a half shot. Okay, so the first thing is that we assume that public charitable officials function in an environment of suspicion. Right? So there are certain things that might even be beneficial for the charity. Right? They're enabling the charity to engage in currency transactions and things like that. Maybe it doesn't matter. public officials live in an atmosphere of suspicion, and therefore they should not encourage, they should not do business themselves. Nonetheless, despite the fact that there's an atmosphere of suspicion, one does not require accounting for them. Okay, so that tension has a lot of horror with a really interesting phenomenon. There are things they can't do, and yet the thing which is most likely to remove all suspicion, which is a detailed accounting, they don't require it. Yes, that's right.
I think the examples are working on within a framework of a public official dealing with money.
Yes.
Not necessarily any other type of need.
No, the public charitable official dealing with money. That's the only, right? I should say public charity official.
Right.
Okay, right, so we're not dealing with an official, we're not dealing with a private charity, and we're not dealing with an official engaging in any other type of business. We're dealing specifically with the figures appointed to, we're dealing with the, managed public funds for charitable purposes. Right, we're dealing, welfare administrators. Okay. Right, so these are the, right, so on the one hand, there are things they can't do lest they be suspected. And on the other hand, we don't require an accounting because we're supposed to trust them. Then we're not able to. Okay, so how do you resolve that? It's problem number one. And then the Ramah goes to position, and it says, and Mikomato, Kadeshi Yidakim, Hashem Yisrael, told Ham Lisan Teshba. Okay, right, even though, right, so it exists in the atmosphere of suspicion, there are things we don't let them do, but we don't force them to do, right, to give a third one, but they opt to, and if they don't, then they fail to fulfill the censor. Okay, so I want to, like, set this up, right, clearly there's a very delicate balance being maintained. This is not being expressed on the basis, it's not like we're saying, oh, then we're not able to see them, and therefore, it's obviously forbidden to require an accounting. And the Yisrael is correct, then we're going to say, oh, we can require an accounting on the grounds of Yisrael Mekim Hashem Yisrael. And so we're choosing not to mandate the accounting, we're choosing to make compliance with Yisrael Mekim voluntary as opposed to mandatory. And that's a policy choice. And where on the other hand, we say it's Nehapshad, so if you ask what's the ground of the Nehapshad, the ground of Nehapshad in the first thing, presumably, is also Yisrael Mekim. Okay, well, you can always transform the Yisrael Mekim into his neighbor. And so the reason you have to fulfill the Yisrael Mekim is so other people won't suspect you, and therefore they'll violate the question of your term. Right, but therefore, the point is that any one of these can be made mandatory or not. Now, you have to see the children as the attempt to figure out, on the one hand, there is a reason to relate to public officials with trust. You have to figure out why that is. On the other hand, there is a reality that public officials are not related to with trust. Okay, and tentatively we can say that the solution in this particular context is that we forbid them from engaging in activities that generate mistrust, but we don't require them to engage in additional activities in order to generate trust. And that might be one way of drawing the line between the first and second parts of it. Okay, and then the Ramah sets up a moral duty. The problem with moral duties, of course, is that we can then argue anyone who fails to fulfill a moral duty thereby generates more suspicion. Once we frame it as a moral duty, then of course the failure to fulfill it generates suspicion and things get worse. So you look at you and say, why are you not, right? Yeah, so we have to sort of get up and tell people the equivalent of the Fifth Amendment thing. Right? We have to tell, right? We get up and we tell people, you should know that although there is a moral duty to give an accounting, under no circumstances shall the failure to give an accounting be held against public officials. And the point is, don't you forget about that, right? It doesn't work any better than the Fifth Amendment does. The tension gets worse. And the more explicit we make the duty, the more suspicious the failure to give it is. Okay. Then our Ramah says, the whole duty of Gaboyim Afsherim, Avonisha Eidos Kasher, Oshnid Mana Balimus Vechazaka, Tarek Lisan Chaytom. So all this is with a Gabbai who is Kasher. Now, presumably, is that right? What does it mean to say there's a Gabbai who is not Kasher? Who, nonetheless, it's not somebody who was imposed on the community, but somebody in the community, whom the community voluntarily selected. That's a very peculiar phenomenon. We're saying, right, because all the above is about Gabbayim Sharon.
Well, there's still two categories which doesn't apply to. One are Gabbayim who are enclosed on the community, and the other is Gabbayim who are not Sharon. So the Gabbayim who are not Sharon have to be voluntarily chosen by the community, and nonetheless not captured. James Michael Curley, yes. Yeah, you know that, right? James Michael Curley was the mayor of Boston, who was elected to some prison. So it could be there's an outright, so then that's kind of circular, right? Anybody not sure in what way? Not sure because they've been with funds? Right. Right, that's circular, right? So you don't have to give a judgment unless somebody raises suspicion, Mola, you know.
Question is not a formal. I mean, question is formal.
Right. So they claim they have no, there's no necessary, you don't have to give a judgment until somebody suspects you. That's the only difference. You don't have to be proactively give a judgment. But if once somebody suspects you, right. And we just said that ordinarily you don't have to give those accounts.
Yeah.
So unless they're suspected.
Yeah.
Okay. We have declared that the moral duty to account becomes mandatory at a certain moment of suspicion. Now we have to figure out what is that line? Conviction of embezzlement of other charges? Rumor? Right? Accusation? Right? Just put this. It just means you can't do random accounting just because I don't like you, I need an accounting. And that's the only limit. Okay. Yes, Alicia.
Very often people become regular because they're rich. Or hopefully they have money. That's why they became board members. Right? On the other hand, when people are funded by the news of the public cars, not so often they will get to actually make that claim. Right? We're discovering an industry. That people who are appointed by the news of the public cars often respond to the news of the public cars to the claim that they were enclosed with us. They have to be very careful with the I don't know how tactical normal this picture, but after somebody's kindness is up there, I said it was that the person was appointed by a news cover town, therefore they have to get a judgment, so they can have to reach the jurisdictional issue first.
I don't know how practical the Ramah's distinction is essentially. They're going to claim that these are people who have to give a judgment even without being asked. Everybody has to give a judgment on the challenge apparently. I'm not sure where it goes. They just say that the Ramah, this Shulchan Aruch, right, the Ramah specifically, is an attempt to formulate the Harivayel and what he understands as the receptionist in the Harivayel, right? So I'm looking at the Ramah as an attempt to say, how do we put the Harivayel into code language? And the answer is that it doesn't tell you necessarily what to do in any specific case. It gives you a set of guidelines that are in great tension with each other, and might very well be that every case will end up being decided ad hoc. Right? You recognize when you set up codes, there are different ways for codes to function. One way for codes to function is to tell you, successfully to tell you very explicitly what to do in each case. Another way for codes to function is simply to give public confidence when judges are acting by some means other than arbitrariness. This is a distinction which slightly three people like to make about whether codes are intended for the population or codes are intended for the judges. And either, and you can make further distinctions, some codes are intended for the population to be able to evaluate the leaders, and some codes are intended for the leaders to avoid litigation. Right, just follow these rules and you're safe. And you have to figure out, in all these cases, who the audience of the code is and what the purpose is. Okay, let's go in very fast. Okay, so the Ramah ended by saying who is in the following in Al Sibur, the Ramah has a big line, and he ends up saying it has nothing to do. Now we generalize it from Gaboy Saka and money, all that. This is just a general, this is a general attempt to propose a some form of theory of accountability for public officials. And Halakhic theory of accountability for public officials. And on the one hand, a presumption of suspicion, on the other hand, a duty of trust, and finally, right, and finally, a moral duty, a moral but not legal duty, right, not to arouse, to try and remove suspicion, and a distinction about what among who is entitled to the presumption of trust. Okay, I have to frame it in very sharp terms. Okay, so that part is the point of the community, and after 20 years, they all screamed about him, right? They raised a lot of public suspicions about him. Does he have to make an account b'chol echad le'echad? Okay, does he have to account to everybody individually? I'm assuming b'chol echad le'echad means not to respond to every allegation, but that they have to account to every single person. Not, well, so the part is not on the keyboard, so he's not with it, right? So we're talking about the community leader. Right? The community leader, everyone pays taxes. Right? So the Torah, right here, the extreme version of this is, Bill Clinton now, right, Bill Clinton is sued by every taxpayer individually. Right? To account for what he did with their tax funds, because each of us is suspicious that some of the tax funds went to cover up drug deals in Arkansas, the American Spectator, or whatever it may be. So is that a plausible...
Right, that sounds like what the Ali Wiles case is, right? You have a case where the community is now suspecting its leader of financial impropriety. Does he have a duty of accountability? Is he personally liable to every individual such that if he can't do it in accounting, then they demand the money back? Okay, so that, how do you understand, that's an extreme case, right? That's not a possible solution. There just can't be, even if it were possible in a small town, right, there has to be a way in which, right, in which people are not liable to individuals. Now, you could have, you could make him liable to the community, but then you need all sorts of complicated, in order to make him liable to the community as a whole, you need complicated mechanisms. Either you need an extra parnes, civil authority who can function as a representative of the people, or you need, right, so what we have in America, right, what do we do in America to solve this problem? What do we create? No, we solve the problem of liability to, when there's too many litigants. The class action suit, right? So we could develop the class action suit. The class action suit is very complicated and morally deeply problematic phenomena. Right? Class action suit is when you take a million people and you say, you know what, we're not going to look at your cases individually. The cost of litigation for each of you are so high that you'll all get more if we just average you out. Even though that will mean that's going to fail you, right? You have a million people, each of whom believe that they were damaged to $300 by somebody's product. So it's likely they owe $100 million. Right? So each of them has to hire their own lawyer. That lawyer will charge $300 an hour. So they lost $100 in the first 20 minutes. Right? So they're creating class action, but even though some of them probably have $5 of damage, and some of them have $10,000 of damage, it just doesn't work that way, right? So we just jam over. It's a really interesting legal and moral phenomenon, which people have done some writing over how often you can recognize it or not. Yes, sir.
Well, there's also the issue of Harley versus contingency. Once you get into a class action lawsuit, odds are they're going to take contingency rather than...
That's true. But nobody's going to bother taking contingency fee for $100.
Right. No, I'm saying that's another advantage, right?
Yes. Unless you make this worthwhile, or disadvantage, depending on what you think it's good to make it worthwhile for lawyers to, it also raises the risk of the company so high that you settle at a much, because corporate costs of litigation are much lower because they have lawyers on your side. So you have to figure out how you balance the risk that somebody just has people who get enough plaintiffs that the risk is so high that companies have to settle even when there's no justice to be sued against, the risk that many small people will never sue because of legal fees. I don't know. And class actions is a lot of really interesting theory though. Okay, this is the problem. So he says, Hadat Nachra. Okay, so we start with Hadat Nachra tells us that he does not believe that he is engaging in non-rational formalism. Alright? He doesn't think that. Right? He thinks that he's saying that it makes sense. Hadat Nachra, the Nizmana Alpinas people, that if he is elected, Shabiru Tolia Parnas Midasam, such that they elected him as their leader consciously. Okay, he doesn't have to provide an accounting. All of a sudden we're getting into a formal mechanism.
And the formal mechanism here is that it is possible to write a contract which sets out explicitly what the rules of evidence are, even though those rules of evidence are not the normal rules of law together. And for example, I could say that my economic contract, which says that although ordinarily, that I'm going to repair your house, and ordinarily you might think that that if I want to spend the work because your house is repaired, what you have to do is show that your house is repaired. No, I don't have to show your house is repaired while your house is pouring raining, all I have to do is, you will believe me as long as I take it up. And then I swear that your house is repaired, and it doesn't matter the slightest in theory, whether the rain pouring into your house and the roof looks like it's 60 years old, doesn't matter because you agreed to pay me, right? You agreed to pay me if I swore that the roof was repaired. Okay, and whether we're interested in doing this because we think that it's not worth the transaction cost otherwise, or whether we're interested in doing this because we don't really care, all we really care about is the people transfer the money they agreed to, and we don't really care whether it's true or false. It's not all clear that is interested in truth or false in contracts. There's many examples of which often get people very unhappy with the signed agreement. So, you find any law contract nowadays, it says among other things that I agree that I made this right, that I made a kinyan on this obligation in a vested right and before a vested contract. Right? You just find that. Right? It's not true. But once you've done it, it's based on that small dish. So it is really good. At least I don't know what the peer says at all. So it's one of the ways to do things logically, just to create a house that's small in, and once the house that's small in, then there's no way legally to get behind us. Okay, so that's small in gain and damage.
Again, whether that's because we really think it's true or because we think that there's a value in enabling people to create obligations, to create unbreakable obligations is a separate question. Yes?
Do people know that when they're dying?
I explained to them, right? So people often ask me,
I acknowledge that I have made this with a kinyan suitor, in front of the Vesna Kashrus, and where's the Vesna? And the answer is, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It's just creating a job called in, and all sorts of,
of explaining why it's not checker to create a job called in a document, why it's perfectly legitimate to say things, to affirm things that are untrue in a contract. Okay, mostly because we assume everyone knows that it's not true. It's just designed to create. Some people bother. They don't like signing things that are false. We just look at everything. You're not really up to that. All the lucky truths in that. And we look at them, we say, the next one says that it wasn't true. No, no. All that says, it happened. Now you're prepared to believe it.
Replace
the Walmart bathroom with
natural
bathroom. Yeah.
And
we'll
even
know if you see the
world.
Doesn't say anything that's nice, Okay. So the negative is, right, so the way it all comes out, a really interesting, and not at all obvious claim,
it says that any time you elect a leader, you are creating an implicit statement that you will trust that leader's word, such that you can alter, such that they're not private and valuable.
How do you
And then you elect.
This
was correct. No, no, no. You're not a target. I'm talking about it. It's not that much damage at all.
Right, so there are minds that saying, who are you calling the million-dollar people? Is it coming from this stupid?
There you go.
The Gemara, it's finally the
Right? Ramah said, who are you calling the money? Because he knows this stupid.
And this stupid generalizes the core premise.
Right, so molesting somebody is taken as a formal legal statement of trust for financial medicine. It's an interesting idea. So the first thing Harry Lyle does, right, sounds like he's going to be very much against public accountability.
So the first thing he does is claims that he believes that there is a compelling rational argument. He admits it's not a compelling formal halakhic argument, because it's very easy to claim that what does an election have to do with, why does an election create an implicit credibility claim? The election means that they're going to watch you really carefully from now on. That's what it means, right? He creates a formal mechanism because he thinks it's rational that a party should be immune from suit against him, because we treat it as if when we elect somebody we are signing a contract that says that we will trust them.
Okay, now again you have to set this up that the counter is personal liability on the part of leaders to every individual. Right? And that we already said, so he has the reductio ad absurdum. But if you don't create some kind of immunity for a public leader, the result will be, and again, this is not as a joke, the result will be the Bill Clinton phenomenon. Right? And that's why the Supreme Court eventually ruled that presidents have to be immune from personal lawsuits during their term.
The Supreme Court didn't rule that way, but, Supreme Court ruled the other way. But so that's qualified as it had to turn out the same way, because otherwise, how would they be president, right? If 150 different women all choose to sue individually for sexual harassment, right? You spend his entire life, legitimately, right? You couldn't function as governor because you're dealing with endless ethics complaints. And you can't function when you're spending all your time in the private office, right? And you have to when any individual can work you to go bankrupt for illegal fees. And here's, Devos kind of tell you that, this is something that ruined half a year of my life because somebody threatened to sue me. Just the mere threat to sue me could, in addition to taking half a year of my life, could very easily have personally bankrupted me. Had they gone ahead with the suit, it would unquestionably have personally bankrupted me. And the only reason that I escaped was that, thank God, a very generous lawyer volunteered his time. I also have no voice in here today. Because of the jurisdiction of the case. But you understand, this is what everybody has been functioning right now. Lawyers cost $300 an hour. Right? Any time that you are, you are deposed in a suit, a really complicated suit, let's suppose that the deposition is going to take 10 hours. You're not going to lawyer at every moment because anything you say makes you liable to perjury. So we say you are under oath. Any extended case, if you have a case that you take that's going to take 3 weeks, say, 4 hours a day, that's $36,000 in legal fees. But the other side has no obligation of whatever time to do so. The living system has a tremendous capacity to destroy. Just the mere act, if you're rich and you want to destroy somebody else, you can just threaten to sue them in that system, and that will generally works to destroy the other person financially. So you have to be aware, right? That in fact, it is easy for rich people of one party to destroy office holders of another party. So now we have to create the fiction of a defense fund that is not connected to politics. And so the Bill Clinton defense fund, and now Sarah Palin is being sued for because people are alleging that she used a public phone to raise money for her, or something like that, to raise money for her private defense fund, defender from ethics complaint. It's really a very big deal. And so what Mary Lyle is concerned about to me here is absolutely legitimate. Absolutely legitimate. That you cannot allow public officials to be sued as private individuals for the public act. Yes, sir.
I just don't see how we got from having to give accounting to being civilly liable for
Because what is it having an accounting? It means somebody sues you and says you owe me X amount of money unless you can produce a detailed accounting. Now I have to do a detailed accounting. It doesn't matter if it takes me 100 hours for every single person. I am liable unless I can write. The obligation to provide a detailed accounting carries with it the implicit phenomenon.
Is it a detailed personal accounting or detailed public accounting?
Detailed accounting of what I did with these funds.
Okay, I don't know if we're assuming in this world that public institutions have to have a budget, but if we make that assumption, which is the case in most institutions today, would every institution have this accounting already on the books?
No, accounting is the kind we have it, a publicly available accounting is a very modern phenomenon.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, very modern phenomenon. We have armies of people. So we hire numerous full-time accounting companies, but now I'm happy to try to prepare public accounting at the NPL, right? It's a real cost, which I didn't budget for. I have to figure out how to budget for the cost of verifying the budget. Right? In any public office now, there are tons of officials whose full-time job is just to account in the public. Right? That's not sustainable in a small environment. So no, they're spending that right here. Now they advanced budgeting processes, they can do that. They run a cash ad hoc basis, and you wrote down things on your ledger. Double entry accounting is a fairly late phenomenon, right? Double entry accounting is probably what, 200 years or something. That was a great advance. I forget what it is. Accounting is really cool. Accounting is a really, really cool field. And no, at this point we're just dealing with people trying to keep their ledgers on their own. I only have one ledger, right? They're copying, right? Copying is hiring a professional scribe, right? You don't have confidentiality agreements. You have no guarantee that the scribe's not going to blab everything. So I think producing accounting would mean, and we would probably sue the partners for violation for every breach of confidentiality if he shows it to a scribe, right? So it means the partners have to spend their nights doing nothing but copying over it. Right, going through all his ledgers to find the entries related to your tax receipts. I'm okay with that because I think it's out of my own experience. I saw this firsthand that you can be utterly destroyed. Mine wasn't a financial issue, but you can really be. Express my gratitude again to the lawyer who volunteered her time to get me through it. Okay. So he says it's not the dogma. Right? He admits this isn't a formal argument, but he says I have a possible analogy with an apotropos. An apotropos is a guardian, someone who's appointed to act in the interest of somebody else legally. Shemanu Beitin Oavi is coming. Ain't a seraphos of Tajdom. The same Tosak Hashiri for a common Zikin, for Ham for Gabbos Napa. That Tom, Ain't a new Beitin Oavi is coming. Vishim Hafi. And Sarah's lost his judgment. Now, via summon, I'm not sure what that means. I assume it means that there's a public office, right, which is the guardian of the guardianship of orphans. What do you think it is?
The father, it could be the father in
the
new
guy.
You write it in the will.
Oh, the father. Right. Okay, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Probably right. Sorry, my fault. Right. It's the guardian appointed by the will. Yes, much better. Sorry. Okay, so we claim that we have a model, right, in terms of guardianship of the phenomenon of emuna being created, and also gabbai tzaka. Okay, then it's clear from our verses, but if you're not appointed midas tzitzit, we're leaving aside the question of what an electoral mechanism is, leaving aside the question of what happens if you have a community that only has partial suffrage, right? I'm not even talking about the gender issue here, right? Because we assume that everyone that suffrage is the household and not by individual. But let's suppose that you have, what happens if you have, as most places did, you have, the voting is done, it requires a minimum property, right? Which was the case in America, certainly after the time of the revolution. That in almost every state you have a property requirement for voting. So that's to create some kind of legal fiction whereby
the furnace is considered to have been elected by the suffrage of everybody because everybody agrees to participate in the political system, which allows these people to vote and not vote. Some kind of mechanism like that. Yes, sir.
I mean, we're assuming that when
he said
these mommy dots
on
keyboards, it's talking about some kind of democratic, semi-democratic, quasi-democratic process. So maybe it just means, you know, appointed in the means by which the keyboard appoints people, which may be one person whose job is to appoint people, appoint people.
It's a process that we are capable of conceiving as democrats. Right. It has to be willing. It has to be willing. Because if it's appointed by, if it's appointed from above, it doesn't count.
Depends on what above means.
The king.
Right, but the king is outside the Jewish seaboard.
Outside the Jewish seaboard.
That's how I'm thinking, right? I mean, he's talking about the institution of the Gehila, you know, which was, you know, basically an oligarchy, right?
Yeah.
Rich people. But that's not, you know...
But I think that, we have here somebody with a lot of trouble with that. He's, you know, he's negotiating, but he hasn't set the guidelines. He just told you that there's a boundary.
Yeah, that's one thing. I don't think we have to consider it as Democrat.
Okay.
I would... Legitimate
is... Right. Election is right. Legitimate is such a way that lets you make the legal claim that is a voluntary acceptance. Okay, you want to tell me what's your Democratic, that's fine. Okay, but if he's appointed aliyah hatoro, which means by means of the secular political, right, or external political establishment, that is similar, but chazaka v'alimut, or via coercion of his own, whether financial or physical, he goes and says, "Not so mitelah v'avil, then that mashal v'avil afrit nagdo ulimkot v'yadot." So, you know, he has the reign of terror on people. However, he does that. She just should say it's also casual. Then it's obvious that he has to require a cheshbon. We have to give a cheshbon. Again, it's not clear if there's nobody who's going to oppose him, who's going to demand a cheshbon. It's a very complicated thing. And even if he's not on his ass, a people of Ritzana, in Karnala Tagar, Shalonel Kishura, if people issue allegations and even behave properly, the Choshkin of the Shalakya, Mama Tibur Shalokidin, the Dagar Shiraul, his Tatek Bo, Lefir Oth in a Hadayim, as Pisa Shitaraswasa Feshma. Okay, so that's a very interesting set of tests. He says that, first of all, we judge the legitimacy of his leadership. If he is in office legitimately meaning if he's accepted voluntarily, and there's a lot of stuff about it, because it's, you know, addressing the question of whether Jewish political theory doctrine requires some form of democracy or not. You know, it's essentially democratic theory because it requires acceptance, but again, it should be, public acceptance is not the same as democracy. For example, you know, Hobbes argues that everybody accepts a totalitarian state because that's the best of all. Well, everyone prefers order to anarchy, and order requires rule by a non-state. Right, so democracy, it, you know, it's the same notion as in the Roman Empire when you elected someone dictator. That person was right. He was democratically elected, but it doesn't mean it was the government or the democracy. It just meant that it was in its initial stages, and you can do that. You can do that entirely abstractly through social contract theory. They're claiming that everybody accepts the social contract in principle, and they just try to do it. Right? So we should be very careful about using the term democratic in that sense, right? That's part of that. But instead, we have somebody whose appointment is theoretically legitimate, or somebody who has now been accused, and in a manner which, right, here's the threat. So first, has been accused, and secondly, the devil sure willing his tapekbo lefir oth in a hadayah. Okay, he's been accused in a manner that is sufficient to create reasonable doubt, I guess, in the absolute discretion of the judge. Right, there are no evidentiary standards for this at all. That's a really interesting matter. We could have said Adachai, we could have said or Canadian, or Talib Look to Speak. He had a whole set of standards that he could have used. Right, the standard he uses is Rafira Ozan and Diane.
explicit. If you're in the third case, this is right after that. Oh, she's in the specific file.
Yeah.
And the third case is only just six.
So the... Right, so he frames the question as, is there a duty, an automatic duty to create a judgment? Right, is that part of your job as part of it? Right, to provide regular public accounting? And the answer to that question is no. A legitimate plaintiff, against whom no questions have been raised, does not have an affirmative duty to provide an accounting.
So the main
problem is
whether all, like, every
time you
should have
an
accounting for the action?
So that's just figure out what is the main question. That was just
how
to analyze the
situation
rhetorically,
right?
He gets back to the third question, right? This is the first one who knows the actual child. But he gets around to it, right?
So what is...
The only child is somebody accused of finance, right? So we have to give an accounting. It tells you, well, maybe every finance has to give an accounting to everyone who asks, because that's part of the job of finance, is you have to account for your actions whenever anyone asks to anyone individually. Answer, no, that can't be. Right? So you can't require every finance, even if, right, who has not been credibly accused of any wrongdoing, to provide personal accounting every day.
Where's that
coming from?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Then your answer is no. It can't be. Right. But then he said, right, but right. And I think the rhetorical strategy of this tshuva, right, I think he
so let's get on that frame this politically. He's a rough someone. Right? And this goes back to the conversation with Jeffrey Rubin. The political task of a lovely Adayan, a judge, is to create a system that the powerful are willing to use, that is nonetheless as fair as possible to the powerless. If you create a system which is fair to the powerless, but the powerful will avoid, you will accomplish nothing at all. So he has to create a tshuva that, in general, the parnassim of Europe will be willing to accept as precedent so that that can become part of the moral relationship between the parnassim and the people. So the opening of this tshuva, right, is the gift to the parnassim, saying, guess what? I acknowledge that that if you do your job well in the normal course of events, you don't have to worry about the crazy guy who's literally in town filing 50 lawsuits against you for every single fact that you've made over the past 6 years that are required in the original counsel. You don't have to worry about that.
Mm-hmm. Is this going over against
that would be somewhat open and direct way of saying it. I think it's not true. Of course, all partisans are great, and the end of the story blocks them. But what he's saying is, I'm not creating an unreasonable burden. And he knows perfectly well that he creates an unreasonable burden and no case ever done the best. And that's why it's an impressive standard. And if you set up a standard that is impossible in practice, then nobody's going to go to business. Yes.
Did he have some sort of fear of things going into the technical part at all?
Could be, right? So certainly we know, right? We know that's
one of the concerns we have is that that people leave this, right? And when interest rate disputes get into executive court, that's bad for everybody. That's almost always an occasion for, right, for direct crown interference in social status. Right? So nobody really wants that. Now he preserves
Now, you know, this he preserves the independence of the dyad. And this really is a very interesting political finale. What he says here is that we have the political leader, and we have the community. The community is now demanding an accounting from the political leader. The answer is, the community can only demand an accounting from the public leader if they have an accusation that the independent dyad sees as sufficiently credible to generate doubt. And he can provide no standards as to what that is. So this model presumes that both sides trust the dyad. Because whenever you set up a system which is predicated on the arbitrary, capacity, or the standardless capacity of a third party to make decisions, you better make sure that both parties accept, that both parties have that trust. And that's what we want to generalize, it's true, we have to recognize that that's the presumption of this, is that we can establish a system in which both those in power and those not in power will be willing to trust, will be willing to trust an external third party who will simply exercise their discretion on the standard. Is there a credible basis for petition? Yes.
This is like what they said in the response oftentimes to about creative support state. This is what we're doing is just bind it down as a new political entity that is used as a check on the party.
We'll have to figure out a way. So the question, right, so when we got Rosenblatt started, he talked about how the way he wanted to settle the sexual abuse cases was by creating an independent committee. To try and do that, right? So this is a model that people often try to do, right? The way we do in America, for example, is in criminal cases, that's what a prosecutor does. And a prosecutor says there's a sufficient basis to begin a case. For civil cases, the only risk that I know, but you have a judge who can throw out the most criminal cases, you can throw a case out of summary judgment, but if you think, right, which hopefully can eliminate the risk of criminal losses, especially if you impose costs. It doesn't actually work, but it's a nice try.
And how does the legislature
say that? The ethics board is usually not dealing with, I mean, I guess like in Alaska, yeah, the ethics board, which deals with complaints, you know, like a financial malfeasance by the governor, is very much the same phenomenon. If in fact they trust, the problem was, that the state, right, who appoints the ethics board, and that's why, and the legislature, right? The other state ethics board, the legislature puts in the court of impeachment, we have an allegedly independent state ethics panel, but in fact, nobody trusts the state ethics panel because they're all appointed by the legislature. And so let's have a really healthy political culture.
So, does the state
ethics
board
not being
entirely true,
but trust them?
Do the others just rely on some sort of check
now? All the right, if you look at, in all governmental systems, right, people continually try to create objective things. They work for a while, eventually they get corrupted, right, and then eventually, right, and then you have more fun movement, and you create something new, and then eventually that gets corrupted, and right, it's not like there's no formal mechanism that solves this problem. All there is a continual cycle, and you know, better run things have longer runs before corruption and shorter runs before the reform, and worse run systems have longer runs of corruption and shorter cycles of reform, apparently in Hoboken it's about 2 weeks. that's really not good. 35 years, 3 weeks, that's not healthy. But, you know, I think you should be aware, right, that this is not a phenomenon of, probably to a certain degree, it's not a phenomenon to which the Orthodox community is immune. And we have the same kind of problem. It's the political problem is that power accumulates in the hands of the powerful, and generally the powerful and the rich are the same. The only defense for the powerless, with the poor, against the powerful, with the rich, is law. Law cannot be biased against the rich because then it will just be ignored. It's a very delicate balance where you try to be as fair as you can without losing the endorsement of the right of the powerful. And often people want judges today as revolutionaries, but these revolutionaries, you have nothing. And once you win, then it takes a few years, you know, the end of revolution, and it takes a few years before the new growth, the new power will come along and capture the new growth. Yeah.
Or if you have a government
that's
where the power is concentrated
in the government. The government depends then on taxes, taxes are paid by the rich, we're back to the same place we were.
Yeah, well, that's a monarchy.
So there's still a lot of monarchy dependent on the rich to pay taxes.
But the monarchy
has. From where?
The
north. Nah, never enough.
The monarchy is an organization of monarchies, right? How the monarchs keep the aristocracy out of
society. Right, we're in social, right? You have a theoretical socialism, right? We're going to say, yeah. You know, again, you know, I don't need to do political theory, hopefully, you know, you all know it. If you don't, you should all read it. Right? And I just, you know, all, you know, my understanding is that Kalaka doesn't exist, but it has to. It has to solve these problems. And Marie Weil is a very careful thinker trying to navigate a very complicated, like, informal political structure within the confines of Halakha. You have to read this trigger that way, right? Because the folks reading this trigger is actually on this. Right? This is a very, very careful, delicate political balance. And then I argue, right, that the attempt to generalize Marie Weil into abstract political rules that we then enforce in different political circumstances may be very unwise. And if you understand him as navigating a particular dance in a particular circumstance in the English community, right, so you have to figure out how that applies to the 20th century and the 21st century American, it'd be a totally different thing. So you can talk about his values. Okay, right, that's what he comes out. And it comes out that
the first question is, was the Parnas legitimately appointed in the set, right, not legitimately appointed by the existing process, which is appointed by the theory of our political process. Right, this might have, right, and that's the big question, what do we consider a legitimate process? For example, leaders of UJA right now, legitimately appointed by this process. Huge controversy. Right, the head of the Congress of Presidents of Major Organizations. All of these regularly appointed out to be undemocratic organizations. Right? No Jewish charity, right? The Jewish community has no mechanism other than the World Zionist Organization, which is not the world's most carefully regulated election procedure. The Jewish community has no process right now for appointing its leader. No formal process by which the community determines who runs its major organization. Right? So, do we not view Alex as the leadership of the Jewish organization? And I mean, there's like two organizations, like the Federation, or the Jewish Agency. Do we see them as legitimately appointed, or is that a Dalai Musa Kabbalah? Right, so you know that in Israel, the claim is made the Jewish Agency is appointed Dalai Musa Kabbalah, and you know that the Congress of Major Organizations doing huge fights by J Street, and goes to life, and groups like that, and Federation is funded by a self-perpetuating board. Right, like the Harvard Corporation. Right. There's no,
Okay, that's question number one. Now, if you don't meet that test, then of course you have to give a judgment, and so far as we can tell, an individual judgment to everybody. Second test. If you meet that,
so then we have to ask ourselves, right, have you been accused in some manner of engaging in independent review board for the time? Sufficient grounds in their sole opinion, in their sole discretionary opinion, to believe that there are grounds for requiring an accounting. That's it. That's basically the whole truth.
Okay. There's another qualifier. This is about this, right? I'm skipping in the, right here again, he has an analogy to, right, top of the chapter. This is about this, but well, you have to have a snake called Naralov, and you do with the Chikamat Varim Chitritan Lokin on the Tibur, Shalim Gallop El Snuim, El Hasibri Yavaru and Ashim Sayami after Feshdon. Okay, so now you have a claim. Even if the Dayan, even once the Dayan has declared that a Feshdon is necessary, so now we have the issue, who, right, to whom does the
public official has to be accountable. So here, the issue is that he claims that there is a state secret issue. There are legitimate things that the public ought not to know, even though there is no way of getting an accounting, because you can always make the claim that all those funds were spent on covert CIA operations. Right? This is real. This is what goes on in every lawsuit against the government or against the government official now, is that we have the rules of discovery where they have to provide you all the paperwork relevant to the case. Right? This is because you're suing the government because you believe that because you claim that you were tortured in a prison somewhere in Eastern Europe. And you want to sue for civil rights violations, and you sue for the CIA papers, and they come back and they're all black. Because the government claims they were within the national security. So all the evidence that you use your claims that, and if we make that an unanswerable privilege, that's a misconstruction claim. That the executive branch has sole discretion as to whether something is matter of national security, then all such lawsuits eventually will, and that's a reasonable claim, because if you say that someone gets to review it, then there's no longer any information for the president's eyes only. I can make sure it's the president of somebody else's eyes only by suing, right, and asking for that document. There's a legitimate national security ground for claiming that there has to be such a privilege. On the other hand, you have a corrupt president that ends up assassinating. And people claim that all information related to anything is national security. So who's going to force this? You're going to defend the review board. And who is going to defend the review board? Well, it works, right? So we have to trust the judge. I have to trust the judge. Right? So he said either the speed board gets to choose some people, and either an elected independent review board, which somehow will trust, has the same expression of initial trust with the product of that, or alternatively, the judge will appoint a separate review board. The judge himself is not going to be the person, because nobody's probably recognizing that the judge may not have any accounting skills, and they're not capable of actually doing this. But some independent review board appointed by the judge will function to prevent these state secrets from getting out. Okay, now he does not tell you what these things are, and what these things are that you have to hide in the public. Now here we go to Dr. Oppenheimer's piece. Now, how does he understand that those things that are illegal? Yes, Jeffrey.
He thinks it's just embarrassment.
It is an embarrassment or a collateral damage, meaning that he thinks that these are that we're talking about are charitable donations to the gentile poor. Now, which is a category Gemara has, right? They told him. There used to be a room in the Lishka in the Beit HaMikdash where they would put money in, and all the people from good families who were in reduced circumstances would come in and take money without anybody knowing. Okay, so I think the way that Dr. Oppenheimer understands this is that the purpose of not making this accounting public is to prevent embarrassing people who are with people of good families who have been forced to accept public assistance. But I don't think that has to be true. I think there's a much easier explanation, which is, but a major function of public officials in medieval Europe, that public officials in medieval Europe was to bribe the secular authorities. You don't really want to issue public accounting for the bribes.
Right? That's when you get into the Lockheed, right? I don't know if you all know the Lockheed case, the big case in America when Lockheed
was frankly paying extremely large sums to their South Korean government officials because that was the cost of doing business. So that became highly illegal because of the influence buying things, but it's not at all clear that it is entirely clear that there are many environments in which it is impossible to function if you don't pay bribes. Certainly as a business person, there's a really interesting true book from Turkey in the 19th century where somebody has a whole shell about whether they can engage in business with certain countries because they know perfectly well the only way to engage in business in those countries is to engage in bribery. Okay. Somewhere else in Turkey. Okay, it's a very interesting sort of Just so you know, he notices that his shipment always comes in either under or overweight. And tries to figure out how it is, and it turns out that the reason why they come in overweight is because when the Asians in India bribe the workers. And when they come in underweight, it's because the Asians in India didn't bribe the workers. So he calls, the Asians, you may not bribe anybody on my behalf, because you're stealing from the other people, because they're in the Messiah and not as good. And the workers justify which goes in, how much goes into which package. Right? The total amount is exactly the same. The workers justify which package is overloaded, which package is underloaded. So he's all upset, and the guy comes back and says, hey, it's not like you have the choice of being hired. So either you get stolen from, whereas where you brought it. There isn't an option of just getting back with him now. But that's what you should have trying to figure out. Whether there isn't that anyway at all in the gauge of business in India, at that point, without participating in the bribery culture. And it's not like, I think anyone, look at history, the position that you could engage in public business in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, in the late 19th century. Or for that matter, that you could engage in public business in Russia nowadays. Right, without regularly bribing officials is highly unrealistic. Or in most third world countries, government jobs don't pay up. The tip function is part of the professional bureaucratic culture. It's a very modern phenomenon. To read Peter Berger's pieces about this. The notion is, the bureaucratic responsibility is to be impartial and not care about how much they pay you is a very modern phenomenon. And not so widespread. So I think that maybe I was saying, quite honestly, if you published the accounts of the Jewish community, then the Jewish community would be destroyed. I think it's a fair claim. So I would make the claim that I think that the assertion that what is going on to aggressively grammarly violate is an attempt to avoid collateral damage is, in my mind, at the very least a significant overreading and possibly a misread. Now, that doesn't mean that the value of avoiding damage to the innocent isn't about evading the value. It just means we don't have any evidence for the tshuva about it, right, that's the case. Okay. And then Marie Lyle says, guess what? Now he has two layers of independent oversight. There's a judge, and the judge appoints the committee. So this functions in an environment of tremendous trust. The revival system can only function in an environment, right? What happens if nobody believes in the judiciary's independence? Does this work at all? No, of course not. Right, what happens if, as in many corporations, right, they're required, many corporations now have requirements in their contract that you're not allowed to sue, you have to go to arbitration first. And they pick the arbitrators are people who 90% of whose business comes from the company. Now, they know perfectly well the company tracks what their decisions are, and if the percentage of cases that go against the company go to the next percent, then they're going to somebody will want another arbitrator. But you're not going to be independent third party in that case. That's right.
We can all just get this to move to this, as you were saying before. There just needs to be one, perhaps two layers that are independent. It could always be that you guys have to go to some other place. New boards need to get created to be this. So I think that's kind of what we talked about earlier. As long as you have some layer that people trust, even if all the other layers below who are not as
that's right. But it's very hard to get to that layer where people trust. Right? In most environments, right, nobody trusts anybody. So this is a beautiful theoretical solution: create an impartial body that people will trust. But it just doesn't happen most of the time. Yes.
The really difficult thing with Shuba for me, is exactly the situation in which he insists that there needs to be a question is the situation in which Yeah, exactly. Probably it's not going to be one, but if someone comes to make a claim, if someone does have the guts to make the claim, the judges both let him be in the oligarch's pocket, right? Because the person that takes control of the political system by force is also going to impose his own people on the, you know, on the, you end up in this like horrible circular situation where...
That's right, but there's nothing else he can do, right? Because if he just declares it, if he just declares that they always have to give an accounting, right? So he's, you know, he's hoping that he can preserve himself and the rabbinate as some kind of third force. Right? That's what he's trying to carve out a space for the die in a year as an independent third force. Not at all clear that he can either.
How is the die in a year force, Kendi?
I don't know. Let's say in Moscow, right? That was where the point is.
Not.
Okay, so how is he a third force? I don't know.
Almost people get to the third force. That's,
Yeah, back on the record. Okay, so now in subsequent shuvot, you have the shah, who has the title. I assume it's the title, but you should be, it's fun to include the title, if you should be aware that, yes, of course people make innovations when they're obviously wrong. Right, the shah says that if you do have to count right, and everyone else recognizes that the type of operations do are, you know, people do those kind of things. You have the major thing I want to point out in the fifth page too, the underlined line, where he says in Cain, we have a new test, which is that the way in which we undo the formal mechanism, so that recognizes nothing whatsoever here. Right? All there is somebody has pointed. The legal mechanism A is, we assume that part of the contract with any legitimately elected leader, elected again, imposed, is that the public agree is not demanding accounting of him. And the counterpoint is that, of course, only if he doesn't behave in such a way, then I want him to demand an accounting. So, right, how do we gather that? Once we create the mechanism, like Peter Monster, we say, oh, the point is, we believe him, right? How can we ever demand an accounting of him now? I don't care how much suspicion I have. Right, we said we believe him, right? Right. You know, he made a opinion in front of the judge in such a position, saying that he says, well, he touched it. The solution is, oh, no! Right, Desmond now comes along and says, in this fictitious contract you made as a partner, we now have a fictitious condition on the fictitious contract. Because you already, because all this is entirely imaginary. Right,
you understand, right, that this looks like we're engaging in technical logic arguments about what a condition of the contract is, but nothing is real here. It's the equivalent of a social contract, right? Social contract doesn't mean that the first five men got together, or five men and women, or whatever you think were involved in the original contract. It doesn't mean that. It means that we have some kind of fiction about how society got organized. So that's all we're dealing with here. So we're creating a fiction, in the sense that as to how a community and its leaders are organized. There's no relationship to specific psychology in any way. Yes, Joe.
What about societies that actually claim to explicitly write out the assumptions on which they're bound?
So then we would say that so long as they're reasonable, we'll probably follow them. When they stop being reasonable, then we assume that they that we reinterpret them. If they work, we'll give deference. They don't work, I think we would just walk right around them. And it says, like an outside.
We work, and we assume that these would be rather than whatever.
Because we want predictability. Right? We want predictability. Without predictability, nobody's coming to court. But you can always get out of a contract. A non-sade that a contract was not intended that way, right? There's no evidence of this whatsoever. It's just a judicial discretion mode which says that no reasonable man, no reasonable person, right? No reasonable whatever it is, right? That's the standard that we use in various courts, the reasonable X standard. So a non-sade is a claim that no reasonable person would enter into such a contract, therefore it must not be. That's all it is. Okay. The Yehuda has an interesting standard, right? Where he says that his understanding, that he understands the Revival as
demanding, and saying not just that the, I think the Maharal says the cheshbon that has to be put together by public officials, he gets it not from the Maharal directly, but from the shop, has to be different than others. Okay, it's not right. Now he says it right. Now he says it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be the Maharal cheshbonam or kol pras bifundi or any kol. It doesn't have to be a detailed public accounting. Now the question is, does that mean it doesn't have to be detailed, or it doesn't have to be detailed in public? And that becomes controversial in the Rishon Lezion Tshuvot, right? Isn't it that a parnas can, because of this, a parnas can't be held in detailed accounting? That's what you can see in this reading of Rishon Lezion. Nevada says that you can't be held in detailed public accounting, but it can be perfectly well held in detailed private accounting. And then people raise the issue, what about when the kind of activities the parnas has to engage in are the kind for which you shouldn't take receipts? Like what? Right? There shouldn't be receipts. Right? So that's a really interesting question. When the parnas' job requires him to engage in all the book activities so that he could not possibly bring evidence for his things, or doesn't he have a presumption or not? Right? That's a really interesting question.
Okay, yes. What about the anonymous donation?
Yeah, what do you do with that fish?
Yeah, like
for yeah. What about a guy, right? What about the guys, right, who travel, or people who travel distributing charity, you know, just putting cash on people's doorsteps? I don't get with right, any charity which strives not to let the person know who received it, I can't get receipts from them. Right?
So you have this very intention there. On one hand, they don't want to embarrass people, but they want to leave the money tied on the hinge, right? So it wasn't where they would see it. So you can't get receipts from them. Now they're going to sell it.
You have the claim in the end that people who are paid are, not have any kind of presumption of trust. You have the claim that anytime you have a prior condition of office, of course, you have to be accountable, and that, of course, leads to the claim that nowadays the situation has changed, and all people are elected to office on conditions that they produce in accounting, and so that just wipes Mario out of the system. Because we just claim society changed. Okay, that's my analysis of the Mario Lyle as Mario Lyle as such. And we'll discuss it in history, so I'm going to essentially tell you that I understand that there is no substantive form of halachic content to this thing at all. The only question you have to ask halachically are, what are the reasonable assumptions of a community in regard to a leader? I think that it'd be fair to say everything which is just an articulation of that standard. What are the reasonable expectations of the city in regard to the police? And every city is just articulating that standard in some way. There are attempts at defining things that which you might say that maybe it means the expectations of paid leaders or different expectations of unpaid leaders, for example. Maybe it means expectations of elected leaders are different than standard expectations of appointed leaders, but these are all things that might exist in the grid. You have, right, and then you have some kind of recognition of the practical issues, which relate to lack of receipts and whether it's reasonable to require receipts for all public outlays, and secondly, whether there are issues that for which it would be wrong to require public accounting. The solution to that is the appointment of an independent review board. But again, that's not exactly what society is. That's not an independent review, right? It doesn't have any revision to the independence. Okay, with that analysis, we can then turn to Dr. Oppenheimer's article. So the cases he has are the case of the Shoftim, okay, and B, the case of the case of the principal, right?
considering it, he has the show spin, and he has his Wilder case. Okay, he's got the principle. Okay, so let's talk about how these two cases are played out. The Shoftim already says that the correct solution is, as Rabbi Greenblatt said it, was to threaten the Shoftim that you would expose the wrong day. Right? I can get you the port script. So what do you guys think? Let's just claim. I showed him, right, Grimblatt claims that he visited a meat plant. The Shoftim were all using possible knives. So he went to the supervisor, and all the Shoftim were fired. But had the supervisor not agreed to take action, or agreed that said it would have just raised to go to the newspaper and have the right facility. And the reason for this, as explained later, is that way it ensures that the show team at other locations with the same company did not have the reputation part. Now, again, he throws this off to Murray Viles and concerned innocent bystanders. I think that's not Murray Viles. I have nothing to do with that. What do you think of the case? Do you think it's the right solution? You discover that all the shows in a particular time were possible. The supervising rabbi has presumably either been incompetent or corrupt. And what you do is you go to the supervisor and you make the supervisor fire all the people whom he has happily allowed to go on engaging with activity all along. And you do this in order to protect the reputation of the company which has hired this incompetent supervisor and no one detected its failure that was not failure. You thought I'd like that.
I think that there's still some value, right? If this is the case where it was, again, it doesn't do anything to the case where something was, covered up for a long time and it was ineffective, In that case, I still find it hard that someone doesn't get a chance to correct the situation. Should be spared on some level of, embarrassment, right? So long as it's, the match cover is having a more nervous kind of business and whatnot, right? So, there should be some room for that.
Are you happy not knowing that, are you happy, right, saying your customer agency will walk in and tell you, well, you know what, it could be that 20 of our clients, right, if you need to buy 60 clients, it could be that 20 of them in the past couple of years, we had to fire everybody. Because there were certain because our client was producing strange stuff. We didn't want to embarrass anybody. If you don't know what you're knowing, what percentage of the food you're doing for the last couple of years is fixed. So it's a huge scandal. We're not going to tell you about it because that would harm the reputation of the people.
I'm still trying to balance this notion of giving you a chance to correct action in order to create some other way.
Okay, yes.
You think there are a couple different ways to look at it. The most generous view of actions here are just that he is presuming good faith, more or less all the way up the line.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to the show team, presuming that they're acting in good faith, right? Tells them that he stopped, they tell him, okay, I was wrong, they're not acting in good faith, I go the next step up the line. He took care of it. He must have been acting in good faith the whole time. I can wash my hands. I'm done. There are new show teams. No one's reputation was hurt. It's fine. Right? The problem with that is that people aren't always acting in good faith. And it's Rabbi Dean Greenblatt sets up a situation where it's really, really easy for a supervisor who's not acting in good faith to take advantage of him and say, and you know, get rid of the problem with minimal thoughts and continue to act in that faith once he's gone. That's number one. I think number two is even assuming good faith, which just made me confident, right? That has been a favorite plea. You know, it's kind of a very narrow vision of what his responsibility as I assume much better for the plan is. Right? His vision seems to be when I become aware of something that's wrong, right, I fix that exactable problem, and don't do anything about the static stuff that may cause new problems, and when those new problems come up, I'll deal with them as they arise, and I'm not worried about the whole, or what larger systemic problems may exist within this institution, so long as they're, as long as I'm not seeing any symptoms of the problem. So I think there's sort of like two different issues there that he just doesn't seem interested in, frankly.
So one of the things I thought we always assume in our discussions of journalism is that an ideal of journalism means when you can have journalism to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And here you have a situation where solving the problem doesn't require journalism. The only reason to justify going public with something like this would be if we have this broader conception of the public right now. And I just find it, I'm not going to take a stand on the other of it, but I just find it interesting that we felt so uncomfortable with this idea of a public right to know in all the cases we see before, and all of a sudden here, we feel like because a local solution to a problem is a division, and the possibility of a global problem creates a right to know.
Where do we get in the center with it?
Conversations
with her. Okay, you have to go
to the new sense then? Well, I don't think it's necessarily like supporting what kind of even if you think that the public has a right to know that in this particular situation, like there's something wrong with not informing the public. Like, I don't think that necessarily implies that there's a value of the public right to know. It just seems like a concern that is being raised with, like, the problem with not informing people, just with having a sort of minimal amount of action be okay, is not a concern about whether the public knows or not, but just a broader concern about whether it will work. And again, a concern about making a difference, because if people, like, I can believe this might be a good idea. If you really don't have to reveal that much information in order to solve a problem, then, like, fine, that's great. But, like, the reality is that if you have these, like, really set rules about, like, how much information you're allowed to reveal or not, like, then it does make it easier to sort of exploit the system and to just keep, I don't think this is such a bad solution. The only, like, the problem is, like, whether it works or not. If it doesn't work, then it's not a good solution. The whole point of it is to write the wrong society. And if you just keep doing that, if it just creates an environment where the wrong will be done, then it's not like a different value over writing. It's just,
well, let me try it. All right. Let me try it. Would any of you be comfortable saying that, I don't want to assume that this is an accurate report of what Greenblatt did or that it involves
or that it tells us all the specific circumstances. So I just got agreed by the place over here. Right? Everyone is aware of Greenblatt's reputation, tremendous Thomas Kaplan. And I don't have any reason to, you know, to take him on that direct evidence. But we don't want to be kind of the formulation which is say, Robert Greenblatt did the exact right thing, and if a newspaper reporter had done the same thing, they would be engaged in journalistic malpractice. Such that we will tell you that that's the right thing for a Greenblatt to do, but the job of a reporter is to find it out anyway, and then to publish it. That was interesting.
And then we're not only the company's reputation, but also a Greenblatt.
Well, at least that it might be. It's interesting. Like one of the, and I'm trying to write the facts down. This is actually like one of the, that generates like one of the facts that's really interesting. What happens if you help that? What happens if the reporter then asks Trevor Greenblatt about his point blank? Does he tell the truth? Does he have to tell the truth or not? But I want to take that issue. Is it possible? Do any of you comfortable or really uncomfortable? You know, you want to express it. The best formulation that in the same situation, with regard to the same information, reporters and others have different duties.
What do you mean? What is the situation?
Like, in this situation, right, the rabbi walks into town, discovers that at the street that plans in town, all the shows are moving couple nights, goes to the rabbi and says, either you fire all the shows him, or I go to the newspapers, but if you fire all the shows, I won't. Alex, when I go to Rabbi Sires, all the Shostim, Rabbi is silent, and he should be.
Okay.
The reporter comes along anyway. The reporter finds out the story. The reporter calls the story. The reporter comes and asks you
a question. Wait, what place does he find out the story? Like, before, like,
anyway,
independence of
the story? Comes to him who was fired.
Yeah, that was done to encourage. The question is really coming to be a story. I know this, right? The reporter then comes to my green button, so I have a silent. don't publish yet. I'm going to go talk to the rabbi and see if the rabbi finds really you don't have to publish. Now, as you just point out, that this is the fact pattern is ridiculous in a society that has a free press. Because in a society that has a serious press, what, all the shows that the plans are fired, nobody's going to find out why? Right? What kind of absurd meaning competent journalist do you have to have to enable at a major local meatpacking plant for all the employees to be fired and no reporter to find out why?
Where you have all the reporters going
out posting trial, which is going out. Well, they still find out, but should I go find out why? The story only gets started in an environment which doesn't have any investigative journalism. And I'll also point out, of course, there are been, but of course, detail all the other rabbis in town, all the other rabbis in town, I assume. Right? And all the kashrut agencies. And it's necessary to move the note before they hire those shoftim again. So when we're talking about not selling newspapers, we're talking about telling everybody but the newspapers. If we are, right? Yes, we recognize this. Right, yes, sir.
How does one do that? Be sure that the shoftim don't get hired to someone else?
Because they tell them every time they should do. I assume.
Why do you assume that? Schools don't necessarily tell others.
Or not. When the children get hired again. When the children get hired again, he just assumes that maybe assume that the vetting process is in all the other places of competent supervising rabbis. That's right, the vetting process is sufficient. Any shelter doesn't keep it nice.
But it takes a lot of people to get caught today.
Yes.
We got a cop.
It takes a while.
So now you're going to have other views that you don't go through me.
Yeah, and they're going to have a little more responsibility.
Well, yeah, maybe he just told you that. I agree with Mr. Hutchins. It doesn't mean these people are not fellow shamanists. They were never yet. They've done it.
Oh, for all we know, the knives were supplied by the supervisor,
and Rabbi Greenblatt told him to fire them, and then they had no way to turn.
Yeah, it is
still a fantasy. That's the problem with this story, right? That we don't know the details, and the way it's presented, there are, like I said before, there are too many presumptions of good faith
Well, he says the supervising rabbi is in Israel. Right? So you can set the story up that he's being hired as the local mashkiach for rabbi in Israel. Right? As he's hiring a specific list, so he shows to him, and he's just reporting back. He has reporting back, by the way, you hired me in a mashkiach, you know, and guess what, I'm afraid you hired a whole bunch of incompetent shops and fire them all. So you can be more charitable that way, although I would, you know, yeah, maybe he checked out all the other, he really went and checked out all the other places and all the other plants are fine, it was just the supervisor here, if possible. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I feel like something, we need to get a little bit of justice, but I feel like something that happens in a lot of the cases that we discussed, that it was, like, we look at individual cases, so like, it's okay to, like, publish this specific thing or this specific thing, but it has, like, in terms of the public's right to know, I don't think it's exactly the point of the right to know about this specific thing, but public has the right to know if there is going to be a possible trend. Like, maybe there is no problem with all the other plans, so really it's going to be a big deal. But if it happens in 2 years from now, and let's say there's a different person working there, so no one knows that password because it's never published, then like, you're going to have a totally different situation. I mean, if it's never published in the first place, like, people aren't going to know that there's going to be a short gap for it. So I think the public's right to know really is about effective change. I think that's what public's right to know is.
Yeah, no, I'm perfectly, I think you have to... That, to me, is, then address the fundamental question, do you think that overall it's better if transgressions are known or not? And do you want the public record to be accurate, or do you want the public record, or do you want less Russian order to be said? If your goal, that's why, you know, to me, that's why, you know, distinguish between the virtue ethic and the social policy.
For example, so it's like, let's say you're just a guy, he's never getting out, whatever, nothing's going to ever happen. I think that this is something that, like, needs to be published anyway, because so that people understand that rabbis are people also, and you can't just trust them automatically, and things like that. And that, the public for itself, needs to be covered, because that's, you know, real thing.
Right, that's why it's worth to mention the last case, right, which, you know, which is fairly astounding that somebody would still publish this as a, you know, even, I guess back then it was still reasonable that somebody would publish a case approving of somebody's action, that when the principal was found to be abusive, the solution was to hire somebody to supervise him until his contract was up, and then wash your hands of it. Right, you know, now we all get up and say, ooh, Catholic Church, right, for finance. Right, but this is, you know, you didn't ask about the Liner case, somebody still feels comfortable setting it up as a model, as opposed to as the art. Yes.
And the other question is, I mean, in the fallout to the Liner case, despite the fact that there was clearly a systemic problem within the OU, right, and that he kept on getting pushed around and yet never losing his job and never being prosecuted properly, right, at the end of the day, the only person who took a fall for it was him, and not all of his enablers. So you have to wonder, again, I think more about what Ricky was saying, right, is that what's the lesson here? The lesson is you can get away with more or less anything if you can get away with it for long enough.
Yeah, but let's take his model, right? So when the Yeshiva takes the principle of page 130 with abusive children, the incidents were investigated and found out to be true. By whom? We don't know who investigated, who found it, right? Who found it out to be true? That's problem number one, right? Who gets to you need an independent investigation in almost all circumstances of this kind, the first investigation will be a whitewash. That's the first move. Second, assistant principal is hired for a specific purpose of supervising behavior of the principal. The solution was recommended by the postdoc to whom the problem was referred. Okay. Who does the assistant principal report to?
Principal.
Who? Right. What power does the assistant principal have? Right? Who's the review board? How is the postdoc chosen? Right. Now, what would have happened if the principal refused to go along with this solution, as opposed to the principal refusing to go along with the plot, but he's totally sorry, if the principal refused to go along with the solution, then it would have been appropriate to go to the newspaper and write an article saying there was a principal who was accused of mistreating children. The name of the principal should not be mentioned, so there should not be further embarrassment to him.
What? And now every principal in town
is under suspicion. So they need to drive to New York. There are lots and lots of principals. Right, so let's say there's a principal in town, and we write this in Vancouver, I don't know, is there any small town like one, school under Memphis?
Which
town?
Well, two schools in London.
There are two schools. I mean, that's. I'm not in any way claiming this is Irving Greenblatt. I'm taking this article. The article, you have to take responsibility for what it sets up as Irving Greenblatt. Okay? If he still refuses to accept the post-ex decision, then all he wants to accept now is an assistant principal supervising his behavior. Right? We're not talking about accepting being fired or anything like that. Right? Then his name and more details can be written because the rights of the community supersede the rights of the individual certainly. The welfare of the community, but once the principal agrees to the plan for his departure, no other article specifically referring to Britain because that would cause needless embarrassment. This we just say, we learned better. We learned better. We didn't know. Regrettably, this article was published before we knew any aftermath, and we should already have known better, but it takes time to learn. We know better. We know that abuse is real. And they need to publicize. Okay, yes, just in addition.
Did Arthur do it, or did I've never ever post anything like, I guess the retraction is a little more of a clarification.
So far as I know, it's still in the, I have a CD. It's still on it. I would be dishonest to remove it. Yeah, we had a case, I don't want to breach his confidence, but the journalist told us about a case involving a girl which was removed from the story. Do we want to remove this? Do we want to remove the early green bus that we're going to name from the story? I don't know, but, if that's just the source of the public record.
Do you
want
to make a case for announcing causing embarrassment versus causing, in fact, more or less harm if we figure out who needs that.
Right, especially in defending anonymous sources. I think that you're not getting what newspapers do. You write an article like that, of course you're just, right? The only reason that article is effective is because everybody will go around trying to figure out who it is. And then all sorts of people will suffer. You can't do that. You can't, that's gossip columns, right? This is how black and white gossip columns start. You're at a TCO, well, guess which well-known actress was seen in the press and someone under their husband, right? And the mystery novel, at least, that is always followed by a letter, put $500,000 on unmarked bills in that quarter, next week, guess which actress would live that the office topic about whether, in fact, it is appropriate to, ever use, the threat of exposure in newspapers blackmail, because then the public has no, then the public has, no idea what a newspaper is doing the appropriate job on this.
What if, what if a teacher, didn't follow the copyright law and, photocopied chapters of textbooks for their students without, it's a one-time thing, it's not...
I think that notion of proportionality is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I talked about this year the teachers of angels. Because anybody can be destroyed. You can be destroyed morally, but by finding someone thing is wrong, you can be destroyed personally, you can be Knox and Jesse Jackson at one point in the Saturday Night Live episode, you know, just sort of trying to just, you know, really not nice older Mondo, like taking out like a really terribly unflattering picture of older Mondo and just leaving it on the screen in the left. That's how you manage it, something like that. I don't think it was such a good idea, you know, that was just the way that Saturday Night Live script went. I think that I think you have to acknowledge that journalism, investigative journalism, is very liable to turn into blessing, let's be it there. Gossip columnist, you know, gossip columnist has heavy capacity to bless you. You have to figure out what the control on that is. Mm-hmm. And if that's really is giving some people the license to pry into other people's affairs is a real social cost. And it might be that we think it's not, you know, that's why it's not so much that they're right to tell it, it's their right to find it out. Right? So, I mean, Amin talks about, right, the right, you know, going to people's garbage and all sorts of things like that. We discovered in America, when you give a government official that kind of power, you get the independent prosecutor law. I don't know if you guys follow the independent prosecutor law. The independent prosecutor law was, and right, in the aftermath, and we didn't talk about this, I think, right? I think Jeffrey Rosen talked about this. Do you remember the Saturday Night Massacre, right, and the Nixon administration that we talked about, John Lieberman? President Nixon fired a series of attorneys general for their refusal to fire the Watergate prosecutor, and talked with the prosecutor then, right? They all refused to fire until somebody eventually did it. So the solution to that eventually was called the independent prosecutor law, where in cases of public corruption, there would be a prosecutor appointed who was nominally in the executive branch but was not answerable to the Attorney General or the President. It basically could not be removed without permission of Congress. And the great example of that was Kenneth Starr, the wife of the Bill Clinton White Water investigation. And that turned out that the independent prosecutors have no oversight as to budget and no oversight as to mandate. There's basically no control on their behavior whatsoever. And so independent prosecutors just destroyed people's lives. Anytime you were, again, you know, your life is over once an independent prosecutor is appointed to investigate you, because they had unlimited budget, unlimited spend, and this is a lesson that's important all the time. I talk about this in moral issues. Once you spend $100,000, if you produce nothing, you can't end. And so people will spend another $10 million to justify the first $100,000. So unless they come up with something, how do they justify the $100,000 they spend? They will keep on spending more and more just like a gambler. You know, right? And once you lost the first $100, well, how do I go home and explain that I lost $100? Well, let me get it back. And I keep on trying to get it back. So independent reviewers who are not accountable are tremendously dangerous. And since the press is not really accountable in most ways for overreaching, you don't have mechanisms for holding it because, again, as Amin pointed out, the American decision was to hold the press utterly immune for truth, basically, and largely immune even for falsehood. So it's a really dangerous thing. I think you have to figure out if you want people who will have this kind of power as journalists have, because journalists have the power to blackmail. And you can imagine, you know, a newspaper in a small city with a competent investigative reporter could have every rabbi and community leader in town just, you know, dancing at his fingertips, because he knows the dirt about each of them. So, yeah, I'm not saying that as a panacea either. But I don't like, I think that there are grave dangers in legitimizing this kind of blackmail. Like I said, the job of the newspaper is to go to people and tell them, do this or else. Right, resign or else, or resign is one thing, you know, or stop demanding that the railroads, that they stop demanding the new public building be built on his land and start to, right, let it be built on my land instead. Right? I don't like this at all. I don't like it at all. But I think you have to recognize what the alternatives are for you. And in this particular case, where, you know, I think we now are pretty aware that letting teachers who have been abusive just go is a real problem. On the other hand, you have to understand that we have a society now in which people who commit sexual crimes are tarred and feathered for life in a way that no one else is. It's much easier socially to be a murderer. But if you're a murderer, you're released from jail, right? There's no warning, right? There's no warning poster posted in every school within 10 miles of where you plan to live. There's no registry of former murderers. I can get out of it. Pardon?
You still can't get a job.
I just thought circumstances you can't get a job. There are people who are the way to give you jobs. Right? They're
very, very, very few. I mean, some of you, I don't know how I was a murderer, but like, it's from like,
that's true, right? Yes, no, that's also true, but the sex offender that works. Right. You know, anyone's trying to, you walk into Gang Academy and there's a photo from the wall of person X just moved into your neighborhood.
That's part of the country we inside on your own.
So do you want to, do you want to condemn someone's life like that? It's really very hard. Really very hard. Okay, last thing I just want to talk about is that the Wertheimer's response, in which he says that, what, I don't recognize journalism in what you're doing. That's not what journalism does. And he formulated that the problem is that journalism is set out as a check on the formal authority, and Halakha is incapable of recognizing a check on its own formal authority. Right, that's the framework that we set it out in. So that is an interesting challenge, and I want to respond to it as follows. That it's important to distinguish between halakha, the intellectual content, and halakha, the power that resides in the interpreters and enforcers of that content. Understanding between halakha, the intellectual content, and halakha as the enforceable content, right? The people who have the right, who have the capacity to decide and execute that formal content. This is what my taxonomic piece is about, is that gap, that you can have a situation in which the political and the substantive content of the law are in controversy. Because the political content of the law is what the people who currently have power decided is. The substantive content of the law is what God wants it to be. And there's no guarantee that those two are exactly congruent. So when he says that halakha can't recognize a check, what he means is that rabbis are unwilling to allow journalists the capacity to critique them. Because rabbis make the decision. It's worth thinking about whether we want to acknowledge that, or whether we say that part of halakha is the recognition that public accountability is necessary in order for the political and the substantive content of the law to be congruent. There are real prices to be paid in that regard again, which, most strikingly, you get a journalist in ordinary power. But I want to set that up as a possible model which would enable us to meet Dr. Wertheimer's critique going forward. Okay, and so then I want to thank you for your